call the House Committee on Education for January 26, 2007, and I'd like to open up a public hearing on House Joint Memorial 2. And I have asked Derek to review what House Joint Memorial 2 is for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Joint Memorial 2 urges Congress to appropriate the maximum amount of funds allowable to fund the cost of special education. It instructs that copies of the memorial be sent to the President and to each member of the Oregon Congressional Delegation. Members of the committee have before them the preliminary staff measure summary, which has a little more background detail.
Thank you, dear. We have our Superintendent of Public Instruction, Susan Castillo, is here, and along with Eric Richards. Susan, do you want Eric to come up with you, or do you want to start off first, or both? Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for coming over today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Susan Castillo, State Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon. I am here in support of House Joint Memorial 2, which has to do with the funding for special education in Oregon. Just to give you a little bit of history, Congress passed the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act in 1975 to ensure that every child with a disability receives a quality public education, and this act gave educational opportunities to children that really had none. So they did pass the law, and at that time authorized Congress to pay for up to 40% of the cost of educating special needs and disabled children. Well, 32 years after that passage, Congress only pays for 18% of the cost for special education. And recent federal spending trends have not been good. Funding was cut during 2005-2006, and today we receive roughly the same money that we did 2 years ago. So we need more funding because while we've had the decreases in federal funding, there has been a large increase in the number of students with disabilities that we serve in the state of Oregon. Let me just give you a couple of numbers here. In 1990-1991, Oregon served 53,000 students with special needs. In 2005-2006, Oregon served 73,000 students with special needs. And this increase can be attributed to a growing population and advances in the diagnosis of children with special needs. So in short, the need of our special education funding is rising while the federal government provides less funding. So we need to send a friendly but stern message to Congress and the Oregon delegation that we need their financial help to ensure that our students with special needs and disabilities receive the best education we can provide for them. And that's my testimony, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Any questions?
One question.
Observer?
Yes. Thank you very much, Susan. And what happened if the U.S. Congress, you know, they promised 40%, now it's 18%. What happened if they completely cut out no funding at all? Then it's the responsibility stay on state only, or what could we do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, boy, I sure hope that's not a scenario we see. We don't anticipate that happening. In fact, we are hopeful that we are going to see an increase. We don't think that they would absolutely zero out funding for special education to the states. I think all across this country, states are turning to the federal government and asking for their help and their increased support to help us with increasing loads cases. And so certainly the funding that we have now helps us deliver services to students. And as you know, because it isn't funded at the 40% level, our state steps up and provides funding to help deliver services to children.
Thank you.
Yes, Superintendent Castillo, we're authorized at 40%. What's the highest level the federal government has ever funded us at?
For special education?
For special ed, yeah.
Right now it's 18%, is that correct? Yes. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, 19%?
Yeah. because the highest that we, the highest percentage they've ever shouldered is 19%.
Yeah. Chairman Buckley, I'm Eric Richards with the Department of Education. It reached a point of just under 19% 2 years ago, and at that point a cut took place, and they're just restoring part of that now. So it's now somewhere between 18 and 18 and a half.
Where I'm going with this is, have we seen a, I know it was authorized at 40%, I don't believe that the federal government has ever met its legal obligation, and what I'm looking for is, what is the highest percentage we ever saw from the federal government? I know it wasn't 40, and I was wondering if you had the information on what it was, so we might get a grasp of the trending here.
Chairman Buckley, Vice Chairman Dallum, the highest figure is 19%. The positive news about IDEA is that if you were to go back just under 15 years ago, they languished at about 5 or 6% of the excess cost of special education at that point in time. There was a commitment to appropriate for a number of years, and there were increases for a period of time, and it reached a high of 19, but it is now gone backwards, and there's a long way to go yet.
There's Ed Goff. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair Buckley. And neither person could answer this question, but are other states experiencing the raise of identified students? I know we are because we do an exemplary job with our early childhood interventions. Are we above the mark on that?
Could you please repeat that again?
The question is, how about Washington, Idaho, and California? Are their percentages of identified IEP students the same as Oregon's?
Chairman Buffy, Representative Comp, the figures nationally are somewhere between 13 and 14% of the number of students having a disability or special needs and being on an IEP. In Oregon, we are currently at 12.9%. Our neighbors are anywhere from 0.3 to 0.4 on the high or low end of that.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder, and I have all these personal stories, and I have a daughter and a sister-in-law who are special ed teachers. It's my impression that there are many things that they do that are required by federal regulation that was supposed to go along with that, and which the finance system about. Is that a correct assertion? Are there federal regulations about what goes on in special ed that end up costing us a lot of money and end up without us having any money in return?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, there are regulations that are very much attached to the Act, and they are part of the requirements under the Act, I don't know if Eric wants to give some more specifics on what some of those are, but yes, absolutely, including individual plans for students to help meet their needs and to track their progress, which actually is, we are now knowing that is best practices for all students to have an individual plan and learning from the benefits of what has happened in special education from that.
Representative Greenlee, Chairman Buckley. The latest version of the federal law was the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act of 2004. The law was passed and the regulations came out in August of this past year. There are more requirements, more data requests, more reporting requirements every year. It is a very large task to maintain compliance. Now, of course, every state, the state education agency and the legislature and the state can go beyond those minimal requirements of law, and or they can just comply with the minimum requirements. We are largely congruent with the federal law, but there's a lot of work involved, even with the Paperwork Reduction Act. We have monitoring responsibilities, capacity building responsibilities, personnel development responsibilities, data collection and reporting responsibilities, just to name five of the key areas, and there are many others.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. One more question. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we're discussing this special ed children, my concern is the cost. Mm-hmm. How much will it average cost more than the normal kids? And it is two times, one and a half. Of course, it might be depend upon the person, but in an average way, what can you give me the estimation?
Chairman Buckley, Representative Lim, are you talking about the additional federal revenues that would be required to come up to 40%?
No, I'm talking about the educating the special child. How much will it cost more than just the normal kids, normal children?
Well, I can give you the national averages right now, and we're somewhere in the ballpark of that.
Okay.
The average per pupil expenditure for a student across the United States is $7,350. For kids who are on IEPs, they are costing approximately $12,300 a year to educate.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Donald.
Yes, when I talk about the 18% figure on the reauthorization of the Special Ed Act, does the 18% cover the time in developing the paperwork and administering just the paperwork? Is the federal government paying for what it mandates in additional work? Might be an opinion more than a question you can get at.
The answer's no.
And I guess I'll direct this to the superintendent. What I'm getting at is, are we being, having been through the process so many times, it would seem to me that the 18% would not cover the paper that we generate. But I would want somebody that's certifiably smart to enter that into the record.
I don't know if I could divide it into how much of that covers paperwork or not, but we know that the 18% does not fully fund, the needs in Oregon. I will say that we have been getting some wonderful results from a program called Response to Intervention. Mr. Chair, as Representative Lim, just to get to follow up to your concerns about the growing costs, and it is an early intervention program that we have been piloting, and now we're going to be expanding in the state, that helps to identify children very early on and match them up with appropriate services so that we can help prevent them from needing special education services later on. And it's really showing some great results, and the districts that have been piloting it are very supportive, and there's a lot of interest in the program, and we will continue to work on it and learn from that work. So.
For members who are not on the subcommittee on education innovation, Representative Comp did have a very good presentation of those programs, of the early intervention programs. Quite impressive.
Mr.
Comp.
Early childhood intervention.
In response to intervention.
Mm-hmm. Just for the record, Representative Dahl may know this, but many of the committee members certainly don't know that I was a special education teacher at high school level for students with learning disabilities, and now I chair an office in Woodburn School District in the interim with a special ed director. And not only does our federal government not compensate us for all the work we're doing, the state and our incredible teachers and staff have developed a form of assessment and monitoring growth in students that is now not acceptable for No Child Left Behind.
Thank you.
For the record,
that was for the record. Any further discussion? Superintendent, just have to note that when you, in your comments, when you said a friendly message to Congress, Representative Dahlem leaned over and said, why does it have to be friendly? And given the circumstances that we face, I have to agree with him. Is there any, just one question that we might or might not know the answer to, is there anyone in Congress who is a particular champion of special ed funding that we might be able to communicate with or seek to support in their efforts to get better funding for
I would say, Mr. Chair, I would say that all of the members of our delegation, we are very fortunate. They are very supportive of our schools, and any time I ever meet with them and talk with them about what we need their help on, they are ready to go. They are very, very supportive of us and advocate for us at the federal level very well.
Very good.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, kind of to answer your question, in 2001, the legislature had a similar memorial, and we passed it and sent it back to Congress. And Representative Hooley, Congresswoman Hooley, was a real champion for us. And I would suspect, matter of fact, I asked my staff to make sure her office knew that we were having this hearing today. I would suspect that she would be willing to take that up. I also, in 2001, she also linked up with Senator Snow from Maine, and together they sponsored Senator Snow on the Senate side and Congresswoman Hooley on the House side, sponsored the legislation to, over the course of 10 years, ramp us up. Unfortunately, the bill didn't survive, and so it never got to conference committee, and it never got enacted by Congress. But it was a very good plan, and so I would point out that carrying the message, and as a matter of fact, I have to be in D.C. the end of February, and would be happy to carry the message. But carrying the message back to Congresswoman Hooley, asking her to once again sponsor such legislation. I don't know if she would be willing to or not, but I think it would be worth a shot. And maybe, Superintendent, if you wrote a letter to go with it, that maybe would be helpful as well. But whatever we could do in that respect to get Congress's attention, I think would be very worthwhile. The other thing that I would maybe do is with a cover letter maybe from you and the superintendent to Congresswoman Hooley, specifically asking her to sponsor a bill similar to the 2001 legislation, I think would be a terrific thing too. And maybe we could once again, you know, sort of kick this thing off and get something through Congress this time.
Very good. Thank you, Representative. Superintendent, do you have any other comments or anything else you wanted to say about this?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Richards, as well. We have no one else signed up to speak on House Joint Memorial 2, but if there is anyone else here who would like to make comment, if that being the case, I will close the public hearing on House Joint Memorial 2, and I'm going to open a work session on House Joint Memorial 2. Wait. Representative Dowell,
thank you. Mr. Chair, I move that House Joint Measure Number 2 be adopted.
Representative Dowell has recommended House, has moved that House Joint Memorial 2 be adopted. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crowley.
The only thing that I, and I'm in full support of this and would, you know, like I said earlier, I hope that Congress would actually take it up again and deal with it and do what they're supposed to do, what they said they'd do 32 years ago. But I is there a way that we could potentially make the language any stronger than it
was? I think if you indulge us, what we might do is use the cover letter to express some strong language and encourage our representative to do so as well.
Okay. In that case, I won't say anymore.
Any further discussion? All right, Representative Dahlem has moved that House Joint Memorial 2 be adopted. Without further discussion, will the committee assistant please call the roll?
Representative Klein?
Aye.
Representative Dahlem?
Aye.
Representative Greenlicht?
Aye.
Representative Kopp?
Aye.
Representative Krummel?
Aye.
Representative Lim?
Aye.
Representative Roland?
Excused.
President?
Aye.
Chair Buckley?
Aye.
The motion carries. Representative Kopp, would you be willing to be our carrier for our first measure? Thank you very much. I appreciate you doing that. Very good. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2265.
And Derek, I'll stall for time for a little bit while you get that file open, and if you'd be so kind as to present a summary of the bill, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2265 permits the Department of Education employees to transfer accrued but unused sick leave when they become a school district or education service district employee. It also permits school district or education service district employees to transfer accrued but unused sick leave when they become a Department of Education employee. It declares an emergency and becomes effective July 1, 2007. You have before you in your paperwork, members of the committee, the preliminary staff measure summary, as well as a fiscal analysis by the Legislative Fiscal Office that has indeterminate for expenditures and explains some of the background on it.
Thank you very much, Derek. May we have Morgan Allen from the Department of Education come forward, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Morgan Allen. I'm the Legislative Director for the Department of Education and Superintendent Castillo, and I'm actually pinch-hinting today for our Human Services Director, Mark Hunt, who actually requested this legislation. He is recovering from surgery, so I will attempt to summarize the bill and answer your questions as best I can. I talked to Mark prior. So the department has some unique challenges when we recruit for senior-level staff positions. It's probably no surprise that the vast majority of our potential applicants in the labor pool come from education service districts and school districts. And just to give you an example for the types of positions that we're talking about that we sometimes have difficulty recruiting for, oftentimes those positions require a master's degree. They require 5 years of experience in that particular education field. They require 2 years of experience of leadership. And sometimes they also require a doctorate's degree or Oregon Standard Administrative Certification for that particular field of expertise. And as you all know, when an employee accrues sick leave, oftentimes they look at that as an insurance policy against a catastrophic event for them or their family. And when we're recruiting people and they have interest in coming to the Department of Education for employment, sometimes that can be an obstacle that we have to overcome, because if they're a mid-career, oftentimes the people that meet these qualifications, people that have doctorate degrees, people that have multiple years of experience in the field of education, are mid-career employees and have invested significant time at their current position. And then if they come to work for the Department of Education, they cannot bring their sick leave with them. And there is precedent in current Oregon law and in administrative rule for this. If you're an employee of a school district and you go to work for another school district, for example, or another ESD, your sick leave is portable. Also, in 2004, the Oregon University system had a similar type of issue where they were having trouble recruiting people from state agencies, which is where a large portion of their labor pool comes from. And so now they have a similar thing. So if you work for a state agency, for example, if you work for the Department of Education and you want to go work for the Oregon University system, your sick leave is portable. And as the committee administrator explained, it's back and forth. And oftentimes what I've found, I've been at the department about a month, and oftentimes a lot of the senior level people that come in and work at our department come from school districts, and oftentimes they are called back to superintendents and other high level people at individual districts. So we feel like this is a simple rule. There's precedent for it in the education community and in the Oregon University system, and we're hopeful that it will help us recruit the best people for the Department of Education and for the students of Oregon. So I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have as best as I can. So.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Any questions? Representative Greenlee.
My assumption is that PERS and other benefits remain in force, if this is just one of the pieces of a package.
I will put a probably yes on that again. And unfortunately, Chair Buckley and Representative Greenlee, I'm not a human resources expert, but I do I believe that your statement is correct. And just one other note, I noticed that the fiscal impact came back as indeterminate, and I got an explanation from our Human Resources Department why that fiscal impact would be indeterminate. Is the only way this would actually cost the state any money is, as you know, when someone comes to work for the state of Oregon at the Department of Education or other agencies, they accrue sick time approximately 8 hours per month or 96 hours per year. So the only way this would ever end up costing the state any money is if someone was a career employee, say, for the Portland School District district, and they had, you know, $200 or $300 worth of sick time. They came to the Department of Education, and at some point in their career with the Department of Education, had a catastrophic illness or a serious family issue, then they would be able to use that sick leave they'd saved up with their time working for the previous school district. So that's why it's indeterminate. I also check with the Human Resources Department. We're talking about a handful of new hires every year, so we're not talking about dozens or hundreds of employees for the department.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Four quick questions. Under the current policy, then, I assume that the person, if we didn't pass this, they could be paid. They get paid for the sick leave that's not used when they transfer. Could you comment on that? You just said there's a handful. Is that 5, 10? And third, how do other states handle this? And fourth, do you have a policy to donate that sick leave to people that are suffering through, you know, major illnesses, their counterparts?
I'll start with the last question first because, and again, I apologize, Chair Buckley and members of the committee, I'm not a human resources expert, but yes, if an employee does come to the Department of Education, currently they would lose their sick leave. Other employees at the department, or I believe all other state employees, can donate both their sick time, personal leave time, or vacation time to that person in an event of catastrophic illness. Representative Wisden, I don't know about the portability if someone leaves the Department of Education to go work for a school district. I don't know what happens to their state sick leave. Unfortunately, again, Representative Wisnett, I don't know what happens in other states. I could get these questions answered for you, so if you'd like.
Representative Clinton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you've covered this already and I just somehow missed it. When someone, can you cash out your sick leave rather than transferring it, and B, if not, then, you know, if so, at what rate do you lose a percentage?
Chair Buckley and Representative Clem, again, I apologize. I can get you the answer to that question, and I'm sorry.
Okay. Mr. Chair, can I just comment on that?
Representative Minnick.
Most service, in most systems, sick time isn't accrued in the same way. Isn't accrued to where the benefits are. It's not there in a fund somewhere. Mm-hmm. And in most instances, you can cash it up, but sometimes, my understanding is, in the state system, the PERS system, you can use it to credit time at retirement. So it has that benefit to increase your time and service. That's a benefit, but it's usually not cashable.
I think I can help out a little with that. In 25 years as a superintendent, we have never paid out the sick leave account. The single largest advantage to this program, it would make employees moving from education to the Department of Education on the same par as employees moving from one school district to another. And the single biggest advantage to an employee is when it comes to retirement, and the impact on the retirement is adding a few days, or I shouldn't say a few because that might minimize the effect, but the financial impact on any institution would be nil.
Thank you, Representative.
Derek. Mr. Chair, if I just might add a clarifying comment. If you look at the paragraph 2, the comments of the fiscal analysis, it states that state government accounting standards provide that employees accumulate earned but unused sick leave benefits, and there is no liability for unpaid accumulated sick leave since the state does not pay any accounts when the employee separates from state service. However, as Representative Dahlem correctly pointed out, some school district contracts may allow for pay at some level of unused sick leave at retirement. Now, that's at the school district level, not at the state level. And then again, goes on to talk about the PERS calculation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for explaining. I don't want to get into too deeply, but one of the notions with the unused sick leave, districts were trying to create an incentive so that the sick leave would not be used, and they would have their very valuable employees in the building, and therefore said if at retirement and you've been in the district, the one that comes to mind is 10 years, and I think 15 was often used, then your sick leave would be cashed out. But that certainly is a different issue than is on the table before us.
Representative Krebel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How will this affect employees of charter schools?
Chair Buckley and Representative Crummell, I do not believe the bill would have an impact for people that work at charter schools. If they were employees of the school district and they had sick leave and they came to work for the Department of Education, I believe their sick leave portability would be just as applicable as if a superintendent came to the Department of Education and vice versa.
So, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, so what I'm hearing you say is that the portability would be there for teachers or educators from a charter school that came into state service and vice versa?
Chair Buckley and Representative Crummell, I can get the answer to that question for you, but I believe the answer is yes.
Well, the answer to the question, if I may, Mr. Chair, is only relevant if you're not planning to actually move this bill today. But if you're planning to move it today, then the answer in 3 days doesn't really matter.
I'm happy to listen to the concerns of the committee, and if there is a concern you would like to have that answer before we move the bill, I'm happy to hold.
Chair, can I?
Representative Crummell.
The question is whether an employee of the charter school is an employee of the school district or an education service district. Is that it specifically refers to those two circumstances? The charter school is a part of the school district, then it would apply, or a part of an ESD, but otherwise it would not apply.
If I may, Mr. Chair, the reason why I ask the question is because if you you have many charter schools out there that are actually, it's a school district charter, and but it's a private entity that is, so for example, the Mitch Academies, it's a private entity that actually is running the school on behalf of and under contract to the school district. If the employee is, and I, you know, so I just want to make sure that it's clarified from the standpoint that, you know, in that kind of a situation, is the teacher or the educator an employee of Mitch Academy, for example, or an employee of the Beaverton School District?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Greenlee,
you warned us yesterday to read the words. And the words on this are very clear. It's an employee of a school district or an education service district. I think if they're an employee of a contract agency, it would be something not covered.
Even though
a school district or an ESD employee.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if we, I realize we're not in work session, but I do wonder if we could get a clarification from Legislative Council on that, and if, and I don't know whether it would be good to include the charter school employees or not. But I just want to make sure that there's not any misconceptions or misunderstandings relative to. I like the bill. I think that this is a terrific idea, and I think it can help the department in terms of their recruiting and all of the things that were said about it. But that's just a question mark out there.
Any other comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would be helpful for me, actually, because my understanding of how charter schools really fit will be highlighted and uplifted by knowing this question, whether they really are school district employees or not. I know it's sort of a gray area in many cases. They have contracts, but I'm sure I could learn a lot more if we end up getting maybe an overall thing about what really, how does the charter school really fit into a school district, and how are the folks there sort of classified as teachers or instructors. And I'm sure there's a whole lot of things that I guess I'm not in that subcommittee, am I, Mr. Chair? You're probably already doing that. maybe just answer his question with me.
Where goes your Tuesdays and Thursdays?
Absolutely. Yeah, Rev. St. Clement, yes, we're motivated to provide you with information. Are there any other questions, further questions for Mr. Allen? Mr. Allen, thank you so much for being here today. Is there anyone else who did not sign up to who wishes to speak on House Bill 2265? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2265. In deference, members, to Representative Crummell's question, we will get that question answered, and we'll bring this bill back for a work session next Friday to see if we can at that point clarify it and move it on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I want to open a public hearing on House Bill 2266.
We didn't get our timing down here, Derek.
And I'd like to ask Derek to please review this bill for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2266 instructs the Department of Transportation to inform the Department of Education of the suspension, cancellation, or revocation of driving privileges of a person with a school bus endorsement on his or her driver's license. You have before you a preliminary staff measure summary. The you heard from legislative fiscal is that there was minimal fiscal impact and no statement was being issued. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have Deborah Lincoln, who signed up to testify. Thank you. Welcome.
That's right, I am. Chair Buckley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Deborah Lincoln, and I am the Director of People Transportation and Fingerprinting for the Oregon Department of Education. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2266. The Department of Education issues school bus certificates to all school bus drivers to ensure that they meet all the qualifications and that they're safe to transport children. The department also has the authority to revoke or suspend that school bus certificate if they no longer meet the qualifications. A school bus driver would be disqualified, for example, if they were to lose their commercial driver's license or if it was revoked or suspended. And for an example, like for example, they got a DUI on the weekend and then they all of a sudden lost their driver's license. We don't want them to transport children. Current administrative rule puts the responsibility on the driver to tell their employer, the school district, or the contractor that that their license has been suspended or revoked. And then the school district or the contractor needs to report that to the Department of Education. Sometimes the problem arises when the driver failed to make that notification to their employer. They're choosing to hide it, or it's possible that they may not even be aware that they had their license or their license revoked. Now, some districts enroll in a special program that the DMV notifies them. They register all their employees, and then the DMV notifies them if they have any action on those particular set of licenses. So if a person had a citation, a moving violation, accident, suspension, then the district would be notified, and then that district would notify the department. We're finding two problems in that system. One, drivers don't report when they know about their suspension or they're just not aware of the suspension. And even if a district does receive notification, it's rather slow in the way they get it, or they are slow in taking action because they're so busy. And some districts are not enrolled in this system. So that means ultimately that the department does not know if a driver has had their license revoked. This could mean that a school bus driver is actually out there driving without a valid driver's license, which could create a safety hazard and potential liability for the district or the Department of Ed in the state of Oregon. School bus drivers during the revocation and suspension process have due process, and so there's a little lag time that in getting that certificate away from them. So the sooner that the department could be notified that a person doesn't have a valid driver's license, then the sooner we could get them off the road. During that 2005 legislative session, the Department of Motor Vehicles, because of some federal legislation, now requires all people who drive school buses to have an S endorsement added to their commercial driver's license. And so now we have a very unique opportunity because this is a special class of commercial drivers that sets them apart from all other commercial drivers like truck drivers. So really only people who are school bus drivers would have an S endorsement. The only ones that would actually have it that aren't school bus drivers would be maybe somebody that moved in from another state or somebody who was a former school bus driver. House Bill 2266 would ensure that the Department of Education would receive these timely updates or information that anybody who has that S endorsement has in fact lost their driving privileges. And we currently handle a lot of confidential data, and we have procedures in place to protect that, and we have the ability to go in and access driving records. And so with the assistance of the DMV, we would get a list of numbers that we could actually look up if they were school bus drivers, and then we would be able to take appropriate action. we have talked to both the DMV and ODOT and have come up and found out that they are in support of this legislation, this bill, and that they've agreed to work together with us and make some rulemaking that would be efficient and effective in reporting, creating a reporting mechanism. So I'm going to urge the committee to support this bill. It helps to ensure the safety of children. And I really thank you for your time and consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Deborah. I may say often in the past I would call Deborah and ask her what to do. Do that again, Tim. I don't see a time in here. And understanding of having subscribed to the notification program, should there be a time that DMV has to get a hold of you, or would you handle that in rulemaking?
Chair Buckley, Representative Dahlem, I think that part of the rulemaking, we would agree to a time or either upon request. And we've decided to work collaboratively on that.
Something that would work for both agencies.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lincoln, thank you very much. Will ODE need additional staffing to accomplish this mission? Are the school district staff to perform this mission? Where are the FTEs who will monitor this important program for the safety of our children?
Chair Buckland, Representative Wisman, that's an excellent question. I think that we're talking about 5 to 10 drivers a year, and so I don't see that there would be any impact on staffing. Of course, there would be an impact on the district if they lost a school bus driver, but I don't think they want that school bus driver driving anyway.
Ms. Wong, thank you. Thank you for calling, Mr. Chair. Good response, but do you think the school districts, are they having someone that's extra, you know, that this is their job to do that, or is this a small part of the overall assistant superintendent or principal or something? That's, in other words, do the school districts, you're taking this away from the school districts. So is that a savings within the school district of FTEs? Or?
Chair Buckley, Representative Wisnett, no, it's not going to have any effect on our staffing. We're not reducing any of their work. I'm sure that they're going to continue to monitor their drivers because they're still going to look at accidents, moving violations. What we're primarily after are people who have, because of poor choices, lost their license over the weekend, usually.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlick.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the difference between cancellation and suspension of driving privileges, and we had, I sat on the Transportation Committee in the last session, and we had a fair amount of testimony about many instances where people were suspended without even knowing they were suspended. A more typical example has to do with when you're supposed to file a traffic incident report, and part of it's based on the value of the accident, and nobody can believe how much a fender bender is worth. Now, I had a fender bender that I thought was minor that ended up with $8,000 worth of damage. But the part of my worry is that there'll be people in this suspension process who really are not unsafe drivers, who are suspended for a variety of relatively minor issues. And I'd like a little assurance that when you get a notification of a suspension, you actually look into it. I mean, that there's actually a process that says, okay, what went on here before we suspend somebody who's relatively, who is, in fact, safe to be a school bus driver, causing both problems for the driver and problems for the district or its contractor. It's, while you're doing fingerprinting, is there some way to find out something about what actually went on in that suspension and make some judgments about it?
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlick, absolutely. Let me just explain what happens. You are absolutely correct that sometimes a driver doesn't even know he's been suspended or canceled. The truth is, though, he doesn't have a license, and he shouldn't be operating any motor vehicle. And so if I was to get notification, the first thing I would do would be to go run their DMV record, which I already have authority to do because in the issuance of the school bus certificate, we already look at their criminal background and their driving record to make sure they're qualified to begin with. So when I looked at that record, if, for example, I saw that it was canceled because of a medical thing, writing a bad check, it would give the driver an immediate opportunity to correct that They still shouldn't be driving, though. And so in the process of revoking their school bus certificate, they have certainly have due process. They have time to have evidence, a hearing. Okay. And, in fact, it's probably to their benefit because they might be able to clear that before it actually becomes a serious problem. And we have found that sometimes a driver has driven for an entire year and not known that they had a suspended license. And then during the renewal process, when we check their background and look at their driving record, we actually find that they're suspended for some reason and they had no notice of that. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, it may actually help protect some innocent people.
Do you have a comment on this, Representative
Dahl? Yes, and Deborah, excuse me, from the administrative point of view, I think Deborah covered it, but if your driver should be in one of these innocuous situations where he is suspended but ought not to be, and he has an accident, the exposure to the district far exceeds when you see that a driver has lost his CDL, it sends shudders through your heart. You know, where did he drive? When did he go? So I think the issue is not the innocence, it's to get him up and make him whole and clear him up, but the exposure that the district suffers can be catastrophic.
Representative Clem. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that you answered my question, but maybe I'll just make sure. Each person is part of the certificate process. We'll have their criminal background checked, whether school district employee or contractor employee.
Chair Buckley, Representative Clem. In the initial process, when they apply to have a school bus certificate, mm-hmm. the first thing they do, after they've completed all their training and everything, we look at their driving record and we look at their criminal background and to make sure that they conform with the criteria that they have an acceptable driving record and acceptable criminal background check. Yes. And then at the renewal period, we also check. But a renewal period could be 2 years for some drivers that are younger than 55 and 1 year for drivers that are over 55. And thus you can see that when we start to renew, when we find somebody that's been driving, it's quite disturbing to us to see that, you know, for a period of time, they really exposed the district and the state to a lot of liability should they have had an accident.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Follow.
Are we able to do that kind of continuous notification on the criminal background side as well, or is that, you know, difficult? And this is the part that concerns me. I'm thinking about a contractor, something happens in the middle of the year. You know, there's a different level of communication sometimes within contractors than there are when it's a school district employee. Not always. You know, it could happen in either scenario. I know this is not what this bill is about. I'm very supportive of this. I would also like to do what we can in this other arena as well.
Chair Buckley, Representative Clem, this is a whole big can of worms. Because we renew the driver and we check their criminal background, we do at least keep a check on it. The driver is also supposed to report any criminal activity that they have to their employer.
Sure.
And that's a little easier to get keep track of because they usually have some court dates or it's in the newspaper, and so the employer usually can get some kind of notification. And I've had a very good relationship with contractors and districts, and they're very good about reporting, and even if they are suspicious of something, we would have the right to look at their background because of the release that they have and because we have authority over them. The other thing would be to do more frequent checks on background checks, and it wouldn't be just school bus drivers, but it also could be all district employees.
Just one quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up?
So the reason this is sort of easier to implement is because there's a flag that hits pretty immediately into the DMV computer system or transportation computer system, and the computer can say, you know, S license is now got a suspension that can go. There isn't something quite like that yet in the Justice Department, I know, where all the different databases talk and would just kick out. There's an issue here.
Chair Buckley, Representative Cohn, that's correct. And it's only because of this new S endorsement that we really could start to flag drivers and that are unique to school bus drivers. Prior to that, we really couldn't have done that this either.
Representative Crowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I notice that there's not a requirement that the Department of Education then would notify the school districts or ESDs if there's been a an action against a driver's license. Is there going to be a mechanism for the department then to notify a school district or a carrier that, that a particular driver's license has been has had an action against it?
Chair Buckley, Representative Krimmel, let me just tell you about our process right now. When we find out about a driver, if the district doesn't know, we immediately call them, and then we start the due process on the driver. They get a copy of the letter saying we intend to revoke or suspend their school bus certificate, and that is carbon copied to the district supervisor or contract supervisor, so they're notified immediately. We don't want a driver out there driving at all without proper certification.
Any other questions?
No questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This might not be directly relevant with this bill, but when they hire the school drivers, do they have a drug testing also?
Chair Buckley, Representative Lynn. Yes, there's a federal requirement that all commercial drivers, which now encompasses school bus drivers for since about 1992, undergo a pre-employment testing, and then they have to be in a random pool that they're, they pull 25% of the drivers a quarter for both drug and alcohol testing. And then there's also training involved so that an employer could recognize reasonable suspicion, and they could have testing for those reasons also.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you. As long as you're going to fingerprint Representative Greenlick on the way out, I think we're done.
Wouldn't be the first time.
Thank you very much for testing. I appreciate you being here today. Morgan Allen from the Department of Education.
No.
ODOT okay, Jeff?
Yes.
Thumbs up from ODOT. All right. This is Trisha, would you like to come testify? Please do.
Sure.
Well, you better listen, probably.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and particularly my personal representative, Clem. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 2266. OSEA, as you may know, represents a whole bunch of school bus drivers all over the state, and we all want only safe drivers on the road. And the sooner the Department of Education is notified of driving suspensions, the sooner our drivers can know about them, the sooner our school districts can know about them, and the safer our children are. So we think this is an excellent bill. When I first read it, I thought, why do you need a statute to get one agency to talk to another? And then I decided that maybe that's because of privacy reasons, and that's probably a good idea. So with that in mind, we certainly do support this bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you so much. Appreciate you coming to add your support.
That may not be the only reason.
Right. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2265 and open up a work session on House Bill 2265. And I would entertain a motion.
You mean 2266?
2266. Thank you for correcting me.
I'd entertain a motion on 2266.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crum.
I would move House Bill 2266 to the floor with the DPAS recommendation. Oh, does this have a subsequent referral?
It's not.
To the floor with the DPAS recommendation.
Representative Crum has moved House Bill 2266 to the floor with a DPAS recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair. I do have concerns about the due process aspect of the bill, or not of the bill, but of the process and that sort of thing. But as long as that is worked out between the two departments, so that a driver who is accused, because they're, you know, a driver that gets cited for DUI may not actually be DUI. He may not be under the influence of intoxicants. It may be for a different reason, a diabetic attack. I mean, there's a variety of reasons. Now, granted, that also is reason to be concerned about their driving safety and that sort of thing. So I don't, but I just want to make sure that the due process for the drivers is met, so that if there is an accusation, they're not immediately yanked and not able to work, not able to make a living while they're going through this process, because we all know how fast government works or doesn't work, and so consequently the problem is that it could take a number of months for an allegation like this to be resolved. So I just want to make sure that their due process rights are respected and protected, but I do support the bill.
So no representative, and I'm sure the OSEA shares your concerns as well. Any other discussion?
Representative Crummell has moved that House Bill 2266 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Will be called, please. House Bill 2266 will be passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Dallum, would you be our carrier of this bill, please?
I'll be delighted to be carrier.
Thank you very much. Unless there's any other, any other comments or announcements, Representative Clem? No.
Well, I just wanted to mention, Mr. Chair, that I have the bill back here for the Aspire program creation. It doesn't speak to the funding amount that's, for example, in the governor's budget versus OSA's request, that kind of thing. It just creates the Aspire program and statute. There was a governor's bill. Representative Roebling and I have our bill. We're going to work out, I think, potentially one little line that was off that came up in our subcommittee the other day.
Pretty good.
But gathering signatures for folks who want to sign on to put the Aspire bill in statute.
Representative Lim is grabbing it. Thank you, Representative Clem. Any other announcements?
Thank you.
Members, thank you for your attention and work today, and we are adjourned.
Good job. Very good.